Welcome to Green and Red, scrappy politics for scrappy people, a regular podcast on radical environmental and anti-capitalist politics, brought to you by Bob Bazanko and Scott Park.
Hello, welcome to Green and Red Podcast. I'm Bob Bazanko, co-host. Scott is on assignment today. And we are really happy to once again have one of our most frequent guests, labor reporter Mike Elk from Payday Report. That's paydayreport.com. I would encourage all of you to check it out. And if you feel so inclined, send a donation. Mike does really great work. And currently you're in Rio, right?
Yeah, I'm in Rio, but I'm headed back to Chattanooga in about 12 days.
Well, let's talk about that then, because I believe it's what, April 17th, voting starts in Chattanooga for recognition, union recognition for UAW and a plant there. We've talked to you before about this, especially organizing campaigns in the South. Like I think the last time we talked to you a couple of years ago was in Alabama, I believe. So, and this is in Tennessee. So why don't you start by just telling us a little bit about the background of you recently had an article in Payday Report, which I'd encourage everybody to check out. You mentioned how elections in 2014 and 2019, I believe, didn't go well, but you have a different sense this time. So why don't you just kind of talk about the way the legacy there, the history there?
Yeah, both elections were decided by a few percentage points. I think it was 4 percentage points in 2019. And it was, I think, 6 or 7 percentage points in 2014, and I covered both of those elections. And there's a feeling you get that I've had whenever you cover close union elections. You know, when a union is winning, you can feel it because the union's already there. You know, there's not a lot of doubt. There's so much strength that everybody's on board. The feeling is upbeat. There's not a feeling of panic. In the past two union elections I covered there was a feeling of panic. There was a feeling of how do we hang on to this narrow lead that we have. This is very, 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 very different. And for many reasons, this is different. And, you know, as someone who spent 10 years covering it, and, you know, I actually lived there for a year, you know, and I covered the minority union. They kept a minority union there. So I lived there for a year. It's very uplifting after having covered those fights and seeing friends fired and seeing friends pushed out at that factory to see them so close to victory now. And the dynamics are twofold. One, everything changed after the pandemic, right? There is a new sense of labor militancy. According to our strike tracker, you know, there've been over 3,000 strikes since the beginning of the pandemic in March of 2020. That's over the last 4 years. Not only that, you've seen union approval ratings at near record highs, around 70% the last couple of years. You're seeing, you know, look, Starbucks just had a giant campaign. But what's more important is that the UAW has undergone a process of reform. They kicked out the old leadership. The federal government came in. A number of people went to jail for embezzlement and bribery and other federal charges. And the federal government allowed them to hold a plebe aside on whether or not they wanted to have direct union elections. The union holds direct union elections. And last March, they elect Sean Fain, who ran as a reformer, to come in. And Fain immediately launches the stand-up strike, which was an escalating strike against all three of the big three, which was the first time that the UAW had targeted the auto industry as a whole, which was a smart approach and was something that they hadn't tried before. So, you know, you had this strike, and in response to it, you saw places like Volkswagen raise wages by 11%, start offering all kind of weird bonuses, start playing nicer to folks. And so immediately what the UAW decides to do at this point is they've decided to spend $40 million in organizing in the South in the next 2 years. The UAW has never organized a single foreign transplant in the South. There are some GM and some Ford factories that they have won, but they have won those factories because the union has a neutrality agreement as part of the General Motors and the Ford contracts. So the company hasn't been able to fight. So they've won at those factories, but they've never won a non-union foreign auto transplant at Nissan Volkswagen, Toyota, Hyundai, any of those big employers. So what they did, after seeing all these auto employers scramble to raise wages, because unions are popular, the union is no longer corrupt. And when, in the last two union elections I covered there, the corruption issues played a big deal. You know, you're a northern trade unionist who lived in the South, and you can appreciate that the language they were using was, do you appreciate these corrupt guys from Detroit to come down south? And they played very much on this regionalist leftover from the Civil War rhetoric, which was just awful. And ahistorical, actually, because Eastern Tennessee fought on the Union side. But that's another story. And so, you know, they did all this, and now they don't have that card to play because of the UAW. Now, you know, in 2014, they were showing literature of, hey, look at the two tiers wages. Are you really making that much more if you join the UAW? You know, they were showing images. They ran a $500,000 TV campaign showing images of Detroit and saying, do you want Chattanooga and our brand new auto factory to look like Detroit? So they played on this idea that the plant was going to close. Let's fast forward. We're now at this moment where not only is there not the fear the plant's going to close, it just expanded, actually. They added a new electric vehicle line. So now this is a 4,300-person factory, which, to put in context, would be about as many people as Starbucks has organized through years of organized. So this is could be the beginning of a big thing. And it comes, and instead of being in a situation where we have an isolated union campaign, right? Like the previous ones at Volkswagen or at Nissan, which I've covered, you know, they're making this as part of a national movement. So these organizing committees are talking to one another. Mercedes just announced they have a majority of union membership. This is in Alabama, and they expect a union election any day. They've gone public with union campaigns, both at Toyota in Troy, Missouri, and at Hyundai in Montgomery, Alabama. They've gone public in the sense that they have more than 35% membership sign up. And, you know, if this could create some real momentum because, you know, I think the threat of a good example often motivates people. If you're on an organizing committee and it looks like you can't win, that odds are too high, you're going to start to believe that. But if you see somewhere like Chattanooga that we've fought for 10 years, I think in many ways it's of my generation, the Dunkirk of the labor movement, somewhere that we've never won. I know for me personally, I just invested a lot of time there. You know, we actually found a payday report there. I was living there in 2016. And if we can win there, it will really create a new sense of momentum and I think a new sense of boldness. And I think it will motivate organizing committees throughout the South. And it will show people that you can do this and you can win.
Before we go, I want to have more specific question about that. But since you mentioned Sean Fain, I mean, he's said and done things that I haven't heard in quite some time. You know, he was active like in the SAG-AFTRA and screenwriter strikes and the UAW strike. And he's talking about national strikes and gave a fairly, you know, really impressive speech not long ago talking about how, you know, the ruling class is using issues like gender and sexual orientation and race to divide us. You know, it's kind of the kind of rhetoric that, you know, you and I have like always wanted to hear from labor leaders. Do you think this is a new trend in labor? You're going to see more, you know, militant or at least aggressive workers, because I know at the same time the Teamsters are, you know, talking to Trump and they're the Teamsters, right?
I think Fain reflects, you know, look, the areas of growth right now for the labor movement are among young people and people of color.
Right.
Those are two groups that are much more progressive. We're not looking at the kind of guys that necessarily we grew up with in the Midwest, although it was much more diverse always.
Yeah, sure.
Places like Youngstown and Pittsburgh, there were a lot of diversity there.
Yeah.
So we're not looking at the sort of stereotypical, you know, white, male, blue collar stereotype. We're looking at a much, much more diverse workplace. We're looking at a workplace that's young. Young people have overwhelming approval of unions. You know, and I think, you know, we're really poised for some big breakouts. So I think Fain is speaking to that. And I think it's also important to bring up that now a third of the UAW is graduate employees, right? So he has this very radical young base of graduate employees that, you know, is a third of the union. And then the union is heavily African American too, in many parts. So, you know, they have a union of folks that are pretty progressive. I mean, they come out against Gaza early on, against the attack on
That's
Gaza, the ongoing
striking.
genocide.
That's striking.
Yeah. And now he's called for preparing. They've coordinated all the big three contracts to expire on May 1st, 2028, and they're making noise about organizing for a general strike. So this would mean not just if you had, you know, and I think the term general strike is often misunderstood, because a general strike, in my opinion, is when you have a strike against industry to achieve a political means. Now, that doesn't always mean that every employer gets shut down. I mean, people get into this isocentric debate about, oh, are you going to shut down? No, there's, I mean, there have been general strikes throughout history, and you rarely shut down every employer. I mean, that's just not heard of. But can you shut down the major employers, and can you win a political demand out of that? I mean, that is my definition of a general strike. And so I think what we're seeing is the UAW start preparing for that. And, you know, to give 4 years to prepare for that, I think is adequate time. It's about timing union contracts together, and it's about achieving a real sense of momentum. Now, there are some qualms with Fain. I mean, I've certainly heard a number, but overall, I think he's much better than what we've seen there in the past.
There's I have to say a question about that, especially given the previous corruption in the, I mean, a bunch of those guys are in jail now. So with regard to Chattanooga, it's a union recognition vote, right? Are there like specific like kind of workplace issues that are kind of more important in terms of like pay or benefits or anything
There's
like
very
that?
little time off. The speed of the assembly line is brutal. People get hurt a lot. The pay, the benefits haven't stuck up. And there's a big issue about getting temporary employees into full-time status. So we are seeing those issues emerge.
What's the do they still have the two-tiered wage system, right? Starting people starting out are making less than the guys who were there.
Yeah, they still have a system like that. I mean, they keep people on temp status for years there. So it's pretty rough.
And is the union is the company engaging in the same kinds of practices to attack the union that it had done in 2014 and 2019? You mentioned significant like TV time, and they spent a lot of money and they played this kind of, don't become Detroit card. Are they doing the same thing right now?
Yes, they're doing the same thing right now. They're playing it. It's not resonating as much. I mean, when you have and I think that the thing is, you know, when you have this big successful strike and you have all these notices and you have all this publicity about it, it's really hard to make the argument that the union's going to do something. Previously, in the past two union elections, when you had union leaders literally stealing from the union, the company could make the argument, well, you know, what are you going to get out of this, right? You can't make that argument today. You have a clear example of what can be gotten. And sure, there's some qualms. I mean, we've covered some issues that Fain has had with some of his hires. I mean, he hired a couple folks that were on the wrong side of some major union democracy debates within my union, the News Guild. And you know, I'm sure the guy's not a saint. And you know, perhaps he could be more militant with Biden. But if you look at what was before there, it's much better. And if you look at what most other labor leaders are, it's much, much more advanced. So we're seeing that coming. And I also think, you know, this could, you know, look, I think there's a misnomer sometimes that labor leaders can change everything within a union. And this type of union culture takes a very long time to change. And I think we're starting to see the beginnings of that. And I think having the UAW with one member, one vote is really the beginning of that process, because now the labor leaders in that union have to be accountable. Previously, they were elected by delegates, right? So if you could do patronage, get the right people jobs, you know, who knows who their union delegate is? No offense to the union delegates out there. I know they do great work, but most people don't. But if you're focusing people around a question of who's going to be the president of our national union, mean, I think there was something like over 250,000 people that voted in this election. I mean, that's a fairly large electorate.
Yeah.
Going to have a union leadership that's more responsive. So I think we're in the beginnings of a stage. And that's a union that is undergoing a bit of an identity turn. You see these graduate employees coming in, you're seeing other white collar workers come into that union. You're seeing its industrial base in the Midwest erode. And so they have to go after the auto industry in the South in order to maintain relevancy in that industry.
Yeah, and as you know, that's has always been an issue for labor, right? From the days of Operation Dixie and onward, and the South has always been difficult. So this is, I think kind of really significant. Also within Chattanooga, do you have any sense of what the community, what the community feels about this? Is there community support? Are they kind of, does it seem like they're more integrated now into just the general population?
Yeah, and I think what happened 10 years ago after the loss at Volkswagen was it started more community labor organizations. It started a conversation among the local unions there about how they could get more involved. For a while, they got some money from the National AFL-CIO, which unfortunately was cut off, to have a full-time staff there, which started coordinating. There's a group called CALEP there, which is doing a lot of labor community organizing. And so over the last 10 years, since the first election, there's been a real effort to really organize the community to push back. And plus, this is a small town. People have had 10 years to discuss this, right? And when I say people have been battling it out, I mean, I know multiple guys who were pushed out and fired there. And I think there's maybe 10 or 15% of the core of the folks that were there when I was there 10 years ago.
Just
So we've seen different generations and variations of the union leadership go. They've tried to keep a minority union presence there. They've had a couple, job floor actions. They've won a few reinstatements. They've pushed the company. They've gotten the company to meet with them a couple of times. Not that the company's really done much, but they've been able to fight and they've been able to maintain a fighting presence. And we'll see where it goes.
You are listening to the Silky Smooth Sounds of the Green and Red podcast. Please check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. If you're watching this on YouTube, please hit that subscribe button. And if you're listening to us on your favorite audio platform, please give us a rate and review. It helps us with the algorithms. And if you really like what you're hearing, please go to our Patreon, patreon.com/greenredpodcast, and become a patron or make a one-time donation by going to our website at greenandredpodcast.org and hitting that support button.
Just with regard to labor in general, in the last several years, I think we've seen, again, to use the word militancy, you use whatever word you want, but Sean Fain's a good example. That's Sarah Nelson, Starbucks and Amazon, which you've covered extensively, a lot of teacher strikes. I mean, because the government basically tracks strikes of 1,000 or bigger, which really isn't the way labor is organized any longer. And you've pointed out there are 3,000. I would encourage everybody again to go to paydayreport.com. And also you're looking for donations to help with the cost of Chattanooga too. So I would certainly encourage people to help out if you can on that one. But do you sense now that this is kind of the beginning, this is the new face of labor, there's a momentum here, it will keep growing?
Look, I can't predict the future.
Sure.
But this
you
is
just told me the Pirates are going to go to the World Series.
Hey, look, look, I'm not a professional baseball writer. I'm a professional labor reporter. But I do believe the Pirates are going to go to the World Series. So
I guess
if we win in Chattanooga, I think it makes it that much more likely in my mind that the Pirates will win the World Series.
This is our
revenge. I never imagined, for so many years, I had a friend there who's involved in the community labor group. We always said that we would go get a beer after this victory. And I've thought of that and I've hoped and I've hoped and I hoped. And now I'm flying up from Rio de Janeiro to Chattanooga and I'm thinking about that. And I'm thinking about what that beer might look like or what that party might look like.
Yeah. Because
I've been to the Union Hall the first time there was a huge party getting ready to go that just died, and then everybody left and sucked. Yeah. I mean, it's just, talk about like deflating a room where you use a union election. You know, it turned in, it went from being a party to being a wake.
Yeah.
And the immediate fear that many people felt that they were going to get fired. So we want people in there fighting it out, having these conversations, talking about unions there for 10 years. And so this is what I'm trying to say is that, you know, unions aren't like electoral campaigns. Electoral campaigns can change very quickly. Union elections are about culture and about solidarity and about how people stick together. And that is much longer change. And so I think the ship is in motion. It is moving quickly. And I think nothing's going to stop the ship from moving, you know, at this point. And so if we win this election, definitely opens the door at Mercedes, definitely opens the door at these other plants. And I think we could see a lot of progress.
Yeah. And all the time I've known you and talked to you, this is the most hopeful I think I've ever heard you. So that's really encouraging. Let me ask you another question since you're in Rio right now. You're there, you're filming a documentary. And I mean, just kind of what's your general vibe about Lula, you know, kind of how that's going? And then talk a little bit about the Mariel Franco case, because you've been doing some really important work on that as well.
So I went to college with a woman. I went to college here as an exchange student. I went to college with a woman named Marielle Franco, who was a Rio City Councilwoman who was assassinated in 2018 by paramilitary gangs that have many connections to the Bolsonaro group. And recently, two congressmen and the Rio police chief were arrested for planning the murder of her. This took 6 years, so there were delays, in part because they had the police chief on the payroll. But there's also questions about whether or not Bolsonaro was involved. The gunmen lived in the same apartment complex as Bolsonaro. They were friends. Actually, Bolsonaro helped them to get a prosthetic leg once. Their children had dated. So there were lots of connections there. So there's a big question about who knew who. And also the police chief was appointed by Bolsonaro's right-hand man as part of a military takeover of Rio. To give you a sense of the scale of police violence here in Rio de Janeiro, in 2018, the year that the Brazilian, that Marielle was assassinated, and Marielle was the chair of the city council committee looking into police murders, there were 1,500 people murdered by police in Rio de Janeiro in that year. So, you know, you're talking about a scale where you're looking at five or six people a day being murdered by the police. You're looking at a massive scale of that. And so you've had these paramilitary gangs here forever that really control areas. They control, you know, in these areas, what happened is you used to have these favelas that were irregular construction that, you know, many, 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 many decades ago were shanty towns, but were gradually built up into housing, irregular housing, irregular construction, not always done to code. Not always with streets that only a motorcycle could possibly go up. And so in these favelas, the paramilitary gangs control the gas distribution, which is done on these motorcycles going up these hills. They control the moto taxis. They control often the electricity, the internet, and they often own a lot of the buildings, as well as they run protection rackets with the local businesses. So you have, you know, these guys, the paramilitary gangs are run by cops, right-wing cops. And ostensibly they came in saying, oh, we're going to kick out the drug gangs. Well, then they also got involved in drug dealing too, just as the cops doing it, right? So you have an area of Rio de Janeiro where 1.7 million people live in environments controlled by these gangs. So during the 2020 election, you know, Lula, who was a former trade union leader, was elected overwhelmingly in the favelas that weren't controlled by paramilitary gangs. If you look at the same demographics in these other favelas that are controlled by the paramilitary gangs, they voted overwhelmingly for Bolsonaro out of fear that they could be shot. So they are a real threat to the democracy here. And in 2018, They wanted to kill Marielle Franco, who was the Rio City councilwoman, because she was getting in the way of their profits, their ability to control new areas, and their ability to have oversight. And, you know, to have the chief of police of Rio de Janeiro, I mean, he literally met with Marielle's family. There's photos of it the day after her assassination and was hugging them. You know, Marielle's widow, Monica Benicius, said it was a real shock to her to have someone come up and give her a hug and hold her, and then find out later that person plotted to kill her wife. This was a threat to democracy. And just yesterday, we celebrated 60 years since the coup in Brazil. And I think there's a real feeling here. They're not going back. They're not going back. And this investigation wouldn't have happened unless Lula won. And this could be the beginning of breaking the back of these militias, because now they are on notice that they will be hunted down and they will be captured. And sure, they're not going to get every one of them, but this is huge. You know, these congressmen that were arrested, these weren't just guys killing someone because they were voting against it. These guys were major developers who did developments with the militias, and they were upset that Marielle was getting in their way. I mean, the gunmen were actually paid in land plots. The police chief was paid in these land plots that were major investments. And the one gunman said that he did it because he thought he would have the chance to no longer just be a hitman, but become a millionaire developer.
Yeah.
So there's been a wrench thrown into that system. And does it lead to more people? It could also mean that the mayor of Rio de Janeiro, Eduardo Paes, who's been a Lula ally, he's a centrist, but you know, there's a coalition system here, may not get the support of the PT, the Workers' Party, in the next election. He's part of another party. And if he's denied that, it could lead to a new mayor coming in who might really go after these gangs.
Yeah.
So you really have, this was really a victory for the left, a victory for the forces of democracy, and a victory of that. Now, as for Lula, you know, he's trying. He still has to deal with many of these Bolsonaro folks. But Bolsonaro could be in jail any day now.
Right.
Bolsonaro recently got in trouble. He had to give up his passport because several top generals and spy advisors said that he was involved in coup planning. And that, he was actually just indicted for falsifying his vaccine card. He's never gotten the COVID vaccine. Yeah. So he was indicted for that. But now he might be indicted on the coup planning. And it looks like Bolsonaro might be involved in either the planning or the cover-up of this murder.
Sure.
More likely the cover-up.
Yeah.
Because the former governor of Rio de Janeiro recently said, former governor of Rio de Janeiro was elected in the fall of 2018. Bolsonaro was running for president in the fall of 2018. Marielle was assassinated in March of 2018. During the transition period, the police told the governor of Rio de Janeiro, the former governor, that they knew who the killers were, the gunmen, but were waiting to arrest them until they could arrest the planners.
Mm-hmm.
Now imagine if during the 2018 election, it came out that a gunman who lived in the same apartment complex, whose child dated Bolsonaro's son, who had a close relationship with Bolsonaro for years, was involved in this. It could have sunk Bolsonaro's campaign. So there's a lot of questions. And the other thing is, the police chief of Rio de Janeiro, who covered this up, was appointed police chief the day before by a general named Braga Neto. Braga Neto is extremely close to Bolsonaro. He was Bolsonaro's defense minister and then was running with him as vice president for his second term, which he lost. Neto has also been implicated in coup planning. So there's a lot of questions here about what did Neto do? Why did he appoint them? Did Bolsonaro know something? Or did they know what happened? And did they sit on it for months because they didn't want to hurt in the 2018 election? So there's a lot of questions here. But when you press the police chief of Rio de Janeiro for planning an assassination, that is unprecedented.
Sure.
That sends a message that the big fish are going to be gone after.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really encouraging to see the way Brazil is handling this, because, you know, here you have Merrick Garland, who's kind of useless, who's Trump just, kind of gets to do whatever he wants. So to see the way they're treating Bolsonaro and arresting people is really encouraging. I'm going to ask you, like, if you have any last thoughts, but I do have one thing, because I know a few years ago we were talking about the elections in Pennsylvania, and the progressives, liberals, whatever, were really enthused about Fetterman, and you're the only person I know who wasn't. And I know Ryan Grimm gave you a shout out about this recently too. And so I know at the time you had these concerns about Fetterman. Do you kind of feel vindicated now, what we're seeing?
It's a sad thing to feel vindicated about.
Yeah,
It's
yeah.
not something to celebrate. I mean, it's to laugh to keep from crying. But the writing had been on. Look, I come from Braddock Hills area, which is a nice community right up above Braddock, up on the hill. A pretty middle class area, and in the Braddock Hills area, I knew many people from Braddock involved in that. I went to, I grew up like a mile and a half from Braddock. I knew many people in that community. And early on, when Fetterman came in as a trust fund kid, and he was elected mayor of Braddock, it's a small municipality of 2,000 people. So when he was elected mayor, it was like 300 people voted for him, right? And
Yeah.
then he was a trust fund kid. So he was able to come in and say, well, I'm going to work every day, all day long. I'll be a full-time mayor. And then when he started bringing in nonprofit money, it was very clear that he wasn't going to work with the existing institutions. That he was going to create his own system, and anybody who didn't want to work with him would be cut out. So it was the writing on the wall was there locally about him. And then, 2013, UPMC is the largest employer in the state of Pennsylvania. The previous mayor of Pittsburgh, Luke Ravenstahl, well, two previous ago, he sued UPMC to get them to pay taxes, right? And the incoming mayor, Mayor Peduto, who's no longer mayor now, but Peduto dropped the lawsuit. So Fetterman, right, they closed a hospital in his community, which was a big employer, about 200 people, and also it's very important to have a hospital in the community for lots of reasons.
Yeah.
They close it, and Fetterman takes to the pages of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, and he says, we should never tax them. It'd be wrong to tax them, even though they're the biggest employer in Pennsylvania. And the CEO is making $20 million a year or something like that. So it was always very clear to me that he was an opportunist, and that he would go whatever way the wind was blowing. And I think and even if you look at his more recent record, he there's big issues about air pollution from U.S. Steel in Pittsburgh, illegal exceedances. He's never once spoken up about it. He's called for fracking in Braddock. So yeah, you can play progressive, and that's what he did in 2016 when he was running, and you can dress in gym shorts and have tattoos, but that doesn't really mean much. And so I think, this information about him calling for tax breaks for to not tax the biggest employer in the state, to not say anything about pollution, to not say anything about fracking, it was always very clear to me that Fetterman was going to go with the moneyed interest when the chips were down. Sure, he might talk a good game about taxing the rich, but when there were real deep interests in a community that had serious political power, through my 12, 13 years of covering Fetterman, he's always gone with the institutional power players.
Yeah.
Sure, you can say, oh yeah, Wall Street this, Wall Street that, or but even look at this now, not only has he been really bad on Gaza, but now he's come out against the G about against Biden's emission rules.
No.
Him and Joe Manchin, right?
Yeah.
So he's always been this guy. And I think it's an exercise in branding and marketing that made so many people believe is, oh, this guy, he's a shit talker. He swears, he
Yeah.
says all kind of stuff, right? But if you look at his record, he always folds when he gets leaned on.
Yeah. Well, running against Dr. Oz helped too, a really weak candidate. So do you have any kind of last thoughts? What are you working on in addition to the strikes, the organizing campaigns? Do you have any other issues right now that you're working on?
We have some major investigation coming out, which we will get to.
Yeah, great.
We can't really talk about it now.
Yeah.
I'm working on some baseball projects. I'm working on a documentary with some Netflix filmmakers about the descendants of the Black Jeffersons, of Thomas Jefferson's family. And you know, we're working with the oldest living descendant. And we're trying to build out the publication. So, you know, encourage your viewers to go and subscribe and sign up. It's free to read, but we appreciate the donations.
Yep, that's paydayreport.com. And, you know, I would certainly encourage it. I look at it all the time. It's kind of a go-to source, especially the strike tracker. Strike tracker is indispensable. And, you know, you've gotten shout-outs in all kinds of major media in the last few years from it. So, yeah, I would certainly encourage that. Well, this summer we'll have to get together for a Pirates game. Maybe it'll be the Yankees 1960 revenge in October. So
I doubt that.
Anyway, you have any last thoughts or any last words or anything like that?
Look, I think the Buccos could be a serious wild card contender. And there's two things I've always hoped for: to win in Chattanooga and the Pirates to win the pennant.
Yeah. Well, so good luck. I think Chattanooga is a lot more likely. But, anyway, as always, it's great talking with you. And, you know, we'll follow up after the vote, you know, to kind of give a post-mortem, hopefully a joyful one on that. So.
Sounds good.
Yeah. So paydayreport.com, check it out. A lot of good articles about Chattanooga and other issues. So we would encourage that. And, of course, the work in Brazil and all this. So thanks so much. It's Green and Red Podcast. I'm Bob Bezanko. Scott just isn't here for the day, but he will be back soon. And we will have a lot of shows. And actually, before I forget, we have swag now too, just like you. So if anybody's interested, get a green and red hat for a $25 donation, we'll send it to you. So if any of you want to help us out, you know, as you know, small independent left media is not a lucrative business unless you have like some kind of patrons in Brooklyn or something like that. So we rely on the charity of all you good folks out there. So paydayreport.com, Green and Red Podcast, and help us out. So thanks again. That's Mike Elk of Payday Report, and we will talk to you all soon. So take care.